Hello, everyone. Welcome to Care Partner Conversations, the source for all the latest dementia-related news, topics, and tools relevant to all of us as care partners and caregivers. I'm your host and care partner coach, JT Hunter. I'm a certified dementia practitioner and president and CEO of REMT Care Partner Coaching and Consulting and REMT Media. Thank you so much for joining us today. You know, today's times, you can find plenty of studies that illustrate the various emotional issues that we all face as unpaid family caregivers. But it's not often that the financial and legal issues and aspects of caregiving are given the spotlight. You know, as caregivers, we don't always go into this caregiving arrangement ready and empowered to face those economic and legal challenges that may lie ahead. And I'll be honest, the caregivers that I know, and I'll speak for myself as well, we don't all typically think of all that stuff in the beginning. Typically, we jump in when it arises and we go in head first and start caring. So from this care partner coach, I want to share with you all that it is imperative that you develop a sharp understanding of the legalities that go in to becoming a caregiver. I cannot stress this enough. Educate yourself on that disease you're facing and any caregiver laws, and stay up to date on the changes in those laws affecting you and the person for whom you care. Investigate special caregiving groups, services, credits, and benefits that may be available in your area. You want to stay up to date with those financial ability laws for long-term care in your state, even if you think you will never need it. So today we're going to talk about the importance of planning for the future and having those dreaded, unpleasant, but much needed conversations. And the idea is to have them now before the time comes. We're going to explain and describe some of the most important legal documents for caregivers to know about, explain what we call decisional making capacity for a person with dementia. And we're also going to answer some of your care partner questions that you all have sent in for us today. So I am proud to say that we have the perfect guest today joining us, Ms. Kat McConnell, Executive Director of West Virginia Senior Legal Aid, a free civil legal service provider for West Virginians age 60 and over. Kat began her elder law career at West Virginia Senior Legal Aid as a staff attorney in 1996. She earned both her bachelor's in music and JD degrees from West Virginia University. She is a licensed member of the West Virginia State Bar and lives in Preston County. She has presented elder law workshops at local, state, and national conferences. She has a passion for debunking elder law myths and empowering older people to preserve their personal autonomy. She publishes the Aging in Law in West Virginia blog. I love this. This is BLAWG and Legal Questions Frequently Asked by West Virginia Seniors. Kat, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Well, there's a lot to cover today, and I want to dive right in. But I thought first we could talk about that word. What are advanced directives? You know, a lot of information that I read and that we receive as especially new caregivers, they talk about a lot of different things. But one thing they say is to make sure you have your advanced directives in order, but doesn't always explain exactly what those things are. So if you have time and don't mind, I'm just going to kind of shoot it at you. What are the different types of advanced directives that we should be aware of as caregivers?
Well, first of all, every state has different laws and different legal tools. So that's one thing that's important to recognize, is that I'm going to tell you about West Virginia's legal tools.
Absolutely. Very important.
If you live in another state, they may have different, I think most states have something similar, but they may call them something different. They may have, you know, slightly different specifics in their laws. But in West Virginia, we have a couple of or three medical directives available mm-hmm. that a person, an individual can do. And we also have a financial directive too. The medical directives that we have that you can do your own planning and use as tools for yourself include the living will, the medical power of attorney, and the post form, which is the, it's sort of half medical advance directive and half doctor's order, really.
Okay. Okay.
And then we also have the financial power of attorney, which used to be called durable power of attorney, or sometimes people would call it a general power. But in our law now, it's just called power of attorney, just to keep it as confusing as possible.
I think I still say durable when I speak of that. Yes.
Well, but I think the general rule is if you're saying power of attorney, if you're not saying medical in front of it, mm-hmm. then it might be about money or property. But whatever it is, you can't ever know what it is until you actually see and read the document.
Right. Good point. Now let me ask you this, Kat. You mentioned as far as powers of attorneys. So there is one power of attorney that deals with medical, correct? Medical,
yes.
Is that making medical decisions?
Yes. In West Virginia, we have a statutory form, meaning that there's a form that's right in the West Virginia Code. It's built right into our law. You can actually print it right out of the West Virginia Code. And it's the medical power of attorney is basically just specifically the tool where you choose a person that, if you are unable to make your own medical decisions according to what a physician who's personally examined you says, then this person can step into your shoes and make medical decisions on your behalf as long as that's needed for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question. I know so many caregivers are wondering out there. And again, you know, care partners out there listening today, I'll speak for myself. So many of these things, when I became a care partner in my mid-20s, I didn't fully understand the parameters and what they all meant. You know, people said, go get your power of attorneys in order. So let me ask you this question. With medical power of attorney, it sounds like there's a standard form that we can use. We don't have to go to a lawyer to write that up, per se.
Not only do you not need to go to a lawyer is not even the best person to have a conversation with in
okay.
order to affect them.
Even
but
better.
Yeah, you can actually download ours. We have the, you can actually download them online for free too at wvendoflife.org.
Okay. Okay.
That's the West Virginia Center for End of Life.
Okay. Now, one question I know so many people have is as far as the, well, I think it's two-sided. I've worked with some people, very early stages, dementia, sometimes in their 40s, and they're redrafting or working on these things. And a question that pops up so much, especially people, we're not lawyers. If we write the medical of a power attorney for today, for myself, let's say for JT, when does that go into effect? And when would my spouse have the authority to make those decisions for me? For instance, as soon as we sign it, does that medical power of attorney go into effect?
First of all, you said your spouse, and a spouse is a good possible option for people to name as the person, but you don't have to. And for some folks, that's not the best option, right? It might not be the best option to say, I want my spouse to make my medical decisions, but the choice is yours.
Okay.
You are free to choose any adult you want to make your medical decisions via this medical power of attorney. When does it become effective? That person has no authority whatsoever unless and until a physician who's personally examined you says medical decisions need to get made and JT is incapable of making them at this time.
Okay. So that makes me feel a little better that I could draft that now and maybe consider, I mean, you brought up a good point, nothing negative, but our spouse is always the best option. I also know sometimes, especially in marriages, if one is fallen ill or developed a dementia, for example, at some point, would they be able to make those decisions? But let me see if I'm following you correctly. So if I draft that and we have that created, until a doctor, hopefully trusted physician, says JT is not able to make the best medical decision for himself, that's what would basically trigger that medical
pattern.
Okay.
Yeah, and that person has no authority until that moment. In other words, let's say you name your spouse to have some medical authority, and your spouse has been nagging you to get some uncomfortable medical testing that we should all get once we reach age 50,
right,
for example. And you're like, yeah, I'll get around to it. Just because you have a medical power of attorney that named that spouse of yours to have authority when and if you can't make medical decisions, no authority for that spouse to pick up the phone and start talking to your doctor about you.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The spouse can call the doctor and try to talk, but that doctor has not been given any authority by you to talk to that spouse about your medical issues of any kind or any of your medical records either.
Okay.
That's a totally different scenario. And you could, if you wanted your spouse to have information like that, mm-hmm. like access to your medical records, for example,
right.
You could sign a privacy form, a HIPAA form in advance. Then you don't have to wait until you are incapable of making medical decisions to share information. But that's kind of a separate issue. But the fact of the matter is, just because you signed it and gave that person authority for when you're incapable of making your medical decisions, mm-hmm. that person has zero authority based on that document unless and until that happens.
Now, I know this is one question a care partner had submitted to ask you, but it fits right in to what we're talking about right now. So let me ask you this. As far as medical power attorney concerns, we received a question from a care partner who said it was suggested that they may not have medical capacity. So they're going to talk to their doctor. But her question basically was, is there a point where it's too late to get a medical power of attorney done? And if so, what do we do then?
Yeah, there is a point, because all kinds of legal documents require that you have the capacity to understand and communicate what this document means and communicate your choice that's happening there.
Okay.
So, yeah, you could reach a point where you are not capable of understanding this document, communicating your choices about it, manipulating information, in response to questions about it. So, absolutely. That's the main reason why we plan now, not when it's crisis time.
Right.
We plan while the window of opportunity is open to do the legal planning. But I will say that capacity to make all kinds of legal decisions and to execute different kinds of legal documents, I'm sure you've probably said this in other care partners shows before.
Sure.
It's variable. It's not a on-off switch. It's not a once you've lost the opportunity, it's over forever. Because we all know as caregivers that a person's capacity, it's not a straight line of decline. It's like this.
Exactly.
Up and down, right?
Yes.
So just because I don't have that capacity today to execute that document doesn't mean that I may not regain that capacity in the future. It's possible. Now, of course, when we're dealing with a progressive disorder, eventually it is quite likely that you will not be able to, ultimately you won't be able to execute a new one.
Right.
But
now,
one thing I want to make sure that's clear, and this is a little bit complicated, but the capacity to make your own medical decisions is not the same as the capacity to choose your medical decision maker.
I'm following you. Can you expand on that a little?
Sure.
I'm with you. I think that's a very important distinction.
I may not be able to understand and make decisions about my complicated choices of cancer treatments.
Uh-huh. Right.
But I still may very well have the capacity to know, this is my spouse. This person cares about me. I trust my spouse. My spouse, she will take care of me, and I want her to make my medical decisions for me. I may have that capacity, even though I may lack the capacity to understand the complicated medical things at that point. So even if you have kind of lost your capacity to make medical decisions, if you have a good doctor, especially one who is particularly supportive of patient autonomy, and choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That doctor should be willing to separately assess this idea of does she have the capacity to choose her decision maker?
Okay, let me just take you down this road real quickly and throw a scenario at you and just see what you say. I know you're not a doctor, just if you have any thoughts on this.
Dude, I've seen every episode of House, so I'm almost like a doctor. I kid. No, I have seen every episode, though.
Let's say, so I'll just use myself for an example. I go to the doctor and I'm with my spouse, and the doctor says that I don't have the ability to make this medical decision, and there's no medical power of attorney in place, but he still feels that way. Does the doctor have any power in that time? Like, can he select someone to make those decisions for me or be involved?
Yeah, if you need to have medical decisions made for you because you're not capable, according to your physician, and you have not executed a medical power of attorney, or we can't find your form, that happens too.
That can happen, yes.
We don't have the paper anymore, so if it's gone, we can't access it. Right. We have a backup in West Virginia, the healthcare surrogate law, which...
Okay.
Is the alternative if you don't do that, your planning, or your planning falls through on the medical decision making, mm-hmm. your physician can appoint a healthcare surrogate for you in West Virginia. And that person has all the same duties and authorities that the medical power of attorney would have had you done one. Okay. But instead of you choosing the person, the doctor appoints based on a pecking order found in the West Virginia code, and okay. spouse is your number one choice.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, not to speak for anyone out there, and we're all human. But I also had a thought, if we're being savvy caregivers and care partners out there, also, it sounded like without the medical power of attorney in place and going through the healthcare surrogate, there's always a slight, in my mind, I interpreted, there's always a slight chance. What if I don't like that person, or I wouldn't want that person, and they fall in that. I'm just going to throw it out, and let's say it's my spouse, and I don't never want my spouse to be on there.
There are lots of good reasons why your spouse might not be a best choice. By the way, I think it's very important that, especially if you do choose your spouse, you need a backup too. You need a second, you know, like a backup in case, because you and your spouse are likely to be in an accident together.
Absolutely. I was actually going to ask you this. You kind of just answered it. Would it be good for most to consider, can you just list as if this person can't perform the duties? Once again, trying to think savvy, that may not be a bad idea for people to consider.
Absolutely. The statutory form, which, by the way, you don't have to use our statutory form. There are some other things like five wishes and some other stuff on the internet that you can choose to use yourself, as long as it complies with our law, the way you executed it. But if you did use our form lists your primary choice and then a successor. If that first person's unable or unwilling, mm-hmm. and unwilling is an important thing to consider too, because just because you named your oldest child to be a decision maker does not mean that your oldest child is required to be your decision maker when the time comes. That
Very
person can say, no, I'm out, for whatever reason.
And I've had this question from potential care partners, family members, kind of on the flip side of that, who have said, you know, if I'm the healthcare surrogate or deemed, do I have to, not out of balance, but you know, sometimes we can't. So I think that's a good point on both sides.
Yeah. And if you choose a successor, that successor has no authority if your primary person is able and willing and steps in.
So they're not, that's another good point I should probably bring. They're not joint.
They're not, legally you could have joint.
Okay.
You could choose two people to have joint authority. Okay. I recommend against it for a bunch of reasons. Like, I don't even have to tell you why. Y'all know
why. Right. I think everyone watching can in their minds imagine all those things.
Yes.
Again, it's just a possibility of what could happen. We never know. Now, Kat, let me ask you this. We've talked a lot about the medical, and thank you for explaining those issues. I want to circle back, and I apologize, I was getting ready to call it durable, but for this sake, I'm just going to call it like the other, the financial and other things besides medical. Now, I do have some questions for you on that, and I think our viewers have asked this as well. Now this is different in the sense of, let's say I sign the other power of attorney today, financial durable. Let's say that is signed. My selection has signed it. I've signed it. We've marked it, and it's on record at the courthouse. Does that go to effect as soon as we execute that?
Yeah, actually, one thing I want to point out is it won't be on record at the courthouse.
Okay.
But I'm glad.
I mean, a lot of people, that's what they do. Absolutely.
We do not record powers of attorney, financial powers of attorney, or medical for that matter, at the courthouse as a matter of practice. You may see one attached to a document. Like, for example, if I'm operating under a financial power of attorney and I'm selling my mom's real estate because she's entering the nursing home and I'm taking care of her financial affairs pursuant to the financial power of attorney, that a copy of that document may be attached to the deed in the courthouse.
Okay.
But when she and I got together and she signed that financial power of attorney giving me authority for her, and by the way, this is also a statutory form. It's right out of our law.
Okay.
Right out of the code. It's much longer and more detailed and more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 5 pages instead of the medical, which is about 2.
Okay.
Has lots of different options on it. Also, the medical doesn't have a lot of options in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you execute that form, once you execute that form, once my mom signed it, and it had it notarized. And by the way, I don't have to sign it as the person she's choosing.
Really?
Yeah, it's not.
So it's more about the person.
Yeah, okay. It's not a contract. It's not a two-way agreement. It's a one-way agreement. It's her unilaterally giving me some authority. Okay. And once she signs that and has it notarized and it's legal, from that moment, the authority that she gives me in that document becomes effective. So if she gave me the authority to sell her property, the minute she signed that paper, I could sell her property, whether she has capacity to manage her money and property and affairs or not.
Okay.
That's a big difference between that medical and financial.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it sounds like, let me see if I'm following you correctly. In essence, with that type of power of attorney, mom signed it. It's valid.
Yep, it's effective. She has handed me some authority. Now, she didn't give away her authority. She shared it with me.
Okay.
So she still has, you know, if she put in there that I can do banking for her, for example, I can go to the bank and take, you know, withdraw money from her accounts for her benefit. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's important. The powers of attorney, those agents are always have the highest duty to do it only for the benefit of that principal. So if she gave me the authority to go do some banking for her, that doesn't mean she can't go to the bank. She can still go to the bank too.
Good point.
Sure.
Well, you're walking me into my next issue that I wanted to discuss along these lines. And again, when you don't know the terms, sometimes you use them the wrong way. So I'm not being hard on anyone. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's people that love power. But let me just throw this at you. Someone comes to you and says, I have power of attorney for my brother. What's the first thing that pops in your head?
Let me see the paper, dude.
Okay. Well, and you know I'm kind of fishing here because I know what you would say. But a lot of times I want to hit on this issue that and again, not for always evil purposes, but is it just that broad? I have the authority. For example, with, let's say, my mother's financial power of attorney, do I have the right to decide where she lives?
Actually, no. And that's an interesting question. We have powers of attorney for medical decisions, and where you live is probably not a medical decision, although maybe living in a nursing home might be a kind of a medical decision, but, and we have the financial power of attorney, which covers money and property and assets, but there is no, we don't have a document that would give someone authority that you could choose a person to have authority to make decisions like personal decisions on your behalf.
Right.
We don't have that. if all else fails, the court system can do, you can have a petition for a guardianship. Mm-hmm. The guardianship includes both medical decision-making and this idea of personal decision-making.
Okay.
Where will I live?
I know. I think, again, sometimes it gets muddy waters, and it's hard for family caregivers and care partners to interpret some of these directions and laws. For instance, it's been many moons since I've had to help admit my grandmother to long-term care. But if I'm thinking correctly and sweeping out some of the cobwebs, I believe in some of the things they needed, like, again, many moons ago, was like a capacity statement for my grandmother. And you know, those things make you wonder, like, does that mean she has to be incapacitated? Does the capacity statement say she has dementia, a brain disease? I mean,
I'm not really sure what you mean by a capacity statement, but I can tell you one thing. Different kinds of professionals can assess capacity.
Okay.
And we have kind of different standards that we apply.
Right.
Physicians, social workers, lawyers, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We may be assessing capacity for particular purposes.
Sure.
Like, as an attorney, I may assess your capacity to understand this contract that you mm-hmm. want to execute, or this deed you're going to sign today. Right. I will assess your capacity. Most lawyers would do that informally uh-huh. in most circumstances.
Okay.
More formally in some circumstances, like if you're doing a will or estate planning. Mm-hmm. I think most of those attorneys would actually do a much more formal approach to a capacity assessment so that right. if there's a challenge, they have evidence about it.
Sure, but sure.
Capacity is one of those things that is another word that I think people sometimes use in different ways. It can right. have meanings, but I think in general, the capacity, first of all, in general, as an American citizen, you are presumed to have the capacity to make every choice for yourself.
Right.
We start right. from the default position is you are the boss of you. Mm-hmm. And only until there's been some kind of due process to take your rights away
right.
do we actually ever take your ability to make decisions any kind away from you.
Right.
And that is hard for mm-hmm. caregivers, I think, because
absolutely.
Caregivers, I think it's well known, especially dementia uh-huh. in particular. I think caregivers know that the person they're caring for, it is so common, I think, that that person can really pull it together and really and for a 15-minute interview with a lawyer or a doctor or whoever uh-huh. Really seem like they're sharp and on top of their game.
Right,
but the caregiver
right.
knows, like, oh man, no, this mm-hmm. is not her daily normal reality here.
Right, I live that. Yeah, you know, you think well, she's having one of those moments. Those, you know, sometimes it seemed like she was fully lucid. I mean, especially someone comes in or in front of the doctor, and not to be bitter or mean, but I know I'm not alone in this. When you're thinking, she's not that way with me, or come home with me and see, you know, but you hit on that dynamic of the, I won't say barriers, but frustrations, part of this dementia care partner life. And I keep swinging back to this only to clear this up for care partners, because I think there's a misconception. First of all, there is something I want to say to everyone watching. And Kat, I know you've heard me say this many times. I truly can tell you from experience and also professional knowledge, the disease a lot of times dictates some of our circumstances and decisions. For example, in my situation, the disease made it very clear when it was out of my hands to provide the care that my grandmother needed. Now where it gets complicated or tricky sometimes is when you try to go through the process of even applying for assisted living or a nursing home, in the sense of a lot of times this thing called capacity statement comes up. So what I'm driving is, I think a lot of care partners and caregivers out there have a thought or a notion in their head that says this. Basically, she has to be deemed incapacitated before I can move her or take her out of her home because she wants to stay in her home. And you know this cliche and dynamic. With the disease and the dementia, as it progressed, first, I think my grandmother stayed in the home that was probably unsafe for a while before we made, because it was hard. Yes. And bottom line, I have not met a person with dementia or the family member that's looked at me and said, you know, the time came and that person, mom, dad, my brother said, okay, it's fine. I'm leaving the home that's familiar to me, that I'm comfortable with. And, you know, that was the issue with my grandmother and all. If I break it down, really was, it was hard for this pseudo son, grandson to say, we're going somewhere else, when that was her comfort zone. That's what she knew. And as it progressed,
home is home.
Yeah. And so I think that's where it comes up, the illusion, I'll say, that so many care partners say, I can't move on this or talk to someone like Kat because of the guilt comes in. I think when mom looks at you and said, I'm not leaving my home, I've been here 20 years, and we know driving may no longer be safe, that she's had instances where she's maybe left the stove on too long. And so again, I think this is very important. And thank you, Kat, for kind of spending time on this capacity thing, because to us, sometimes it just sounds blanket. You know,
yeah, it's
the
not.
Board.
There's nothing. There is no black and white about any of this. There is no
right.
Black. There's no black and white. Different lawyers will give different answers, different approaches. I mean, it's a very nuanced, complicated scenario to try to measure out. But one thing that I think is important to recognize too is that. Have you read this book by Atul Gawande called Being Mortal?
Oh yes, I have. Yes.
Love that book. Recommend
it
to everyone.
Very good. I could bet that say you probably recommended that to me.
Maybe you recommended it to me, but maybe. I loved it. One of the things that he said in that book that I found was really crystallizing to me was this idea that he said, you know, especially for older people or people with diminishing capacities, let's say, mm-hmm. our strongest desire for ourselves is autonomy. Like, this yes. is a really fundamental thing that we all want. We want choices and we want to be able to make them for ourselves.
Right.
I might want the choice to fall down because mm-hmm. I don't want to use that walker. I hate that walker. I want the choice to maybe take the risk of falling down. But our loved ones, number one, safety. That's what our loved
Kat,
ones want
you,
for us.
You nailed it on the head, Kat. And again, I'm not speaking for everyone, but this care partner will share his inner thoughts. I'll admit, I was trying to find this balance, autonomy versus safety. And I'm going to be very honest and say there were times in those years where I was this caregiver that said, just put her in a wheelchair, leave her in a wheelchair, because then she can't get up. And if she wants that cookie, she won't. Well, guess what happened? When she was alone in her moment, if she wanted that cookie, she wasn't going to go over there and get her walker. And so this autonomy versus safety.
Yes.
And so I'm going to speak to the care partners, because I think you're alluding to this, is that, yes, it was hard. And there were days where I thought, don't let her walk put her in a chair permanently, strap that belt. But that's wrong. That you know, those restrictions. And it's hard, but it's an honest balance that we feel every day with caregivers, because you want to give them the autonomy and the freedom, but also your safety. So it's like, when do I take this away now? Can they no longer do this?
So hard. And also, I think for caregivers, there are those times, those days, those hours when you are just so spent,
yes,
right? You just don't
right.
have another ounce of energy. And you're just like, please, would you just sit in the chair today?
Right, right. I mean, it's
please,
it's
you know, please, can you just not, you know, well, fall today?
You just hit on this. That other thing that I speak about every day to care partners is, we're human.
Yes.
And I know you've heard me say this, Kat. It is very easy to look at you and say, well, here's all the answers. Mom's always right. You're wrong if you argue with her. Always have a smile on your face. Always be patient. If we're in front of each other, you've already thrown something at me, Kat, because you're saying, you do it 24 hours. Do you? And so here's the reality. You're human. We're human, right? We're going to have these moments. We're going to say that thing that later maybe we regretted or guilt ate us up about. But I always stress this, because in the midst of this dementia journey, let's say, also that means that mom will forget that you maybe lost your patience before you do. Mom may move on from that thing you said that you wish you didn't, But honestly, we're human. And I think we just connected these dots. I first brought up the fact that, yes, if you're being honest caregiver, there's going to be a day where you're like, just put her in the chair because she keeps falling and I don't want her to hurt herself. And someone may look at you and say, that's a restraint.
Yep.
We can't do that.
Yeah. And like you said, we're humans. So one thing about humans is humans need a break and humans right. need support. So the more support and the more you can recognize in yourself when you need a break and can mm-hmm. you get yourself a break.
Absolutely.
I think that makes a big difference too. But
absolutely.
That balance is a hard That's the daily struggle.
And I thank you, Kat, for bringing up the side, because what we're trying to do today is let you kind of see both sides. You know, I always had to understand, and sometimes I put myself in her shoes, I will always need to feel useful. I will always need, you know me, Kat, I need to feel like I have a purpose in this world. And Kat, you've also met my mother. My mother says that she may get kicked out of every facility in West Virginia if you don't have something for her to do. And if you don't know my mom's always been a boss, an executive director. She's inclined to tell you how to do things. So again, there's this balance of, yes, the identity, the person, the capacity to make some decisions, if not all decisions. I believe Ms. in there throughout the entire journey in some level.
I think there's legal authority too for this general concept of agency, the idea of when one person's making decisions for another, it's a fundamental principle of agency that you should be maximizing the input from the person you're making decisions for, always.
I think that's another distinct
point.
And
it's hard. It is.
And again, you know, sometimes you need coaches and advisors to walk you through those fine lines. You know, I know you've said this, but I'll reiterate this. I've had some care partners come to me and say, you know, we weren't sure if it was too late to get this legal document done. So we went to a lawyer, and the lawyer looked at me and said, I need to sit with your mom for a second alone. And they got upset or said, no, she can't. And they, again, protecting the person, not understanding the reason the lawyer wanted to try to sit with that person for a second. So I think you've helped clear that up as well. And again, it's not always across the board. I think of sometimes I would say capacity to do what, you know,
I've
something.
always say that, I think, because capacity is not one thing. It's those individual things. Like we started out at the very beginning talking about, even just medical decision-making capacity is different from choosing a medical decision maker, the capacity to do that. Even those two things are separate. And a person, you know, especially from the financial capacity point of view, that's very complicated, much more complicated. I'm sure that you know people who, it didn't take dementia for them to not have the capacity to manage money.
Right?
Like some people are bad at it when they have high IQs, you know, and everything's in order.
Right.
So financial capacity is much more complicated. It also has a lot to do with your financial landscape too, right? Like you have a lot of complicated assets and, you know, incomes and sort of things, but where if you're living a simpler, low asset lifestyle, you're living in a low income apartment and living on a small social security check and you don't have a car, you're not paying for insurances and whatever, your capacity to manage that little pile there, you might be able to kind of stretch that capacity out for a while because it's not terribly complicated. So it's a much more of a nuanced thing. And I think that anytime somebody says the phrase like, well, she doesn't have capacity, that's just false. That's all. Okay. That is 100% of the time false, because we all have some capacities, right? We all have, even if I can't speak, even if I've lost the ability to communicate with you, when you have a spoon and it's headed for my mouth with a food I don't want to eat, I have the capacity to refuse to open my mouth for that spoonful of food. Am I right? Like all have capacity, and it's all that autonomy thing that we desire we always want people to respect our capacities as much as we have, you know, throughout our lives.
I think, again, you've hit on a really important point, because you're right. That aspect, again, capacity is not what, it's not one thing. It's very broad. And like you said, capacity to do what? But again, I think that's not to frighten care partners or make them feel like it's complicated. We're actually trying to empower, again, because there's an element there that carries over to the one-on-one, responding to behaviors, interactions, activities. And once again, it's just a fact of life. Sometimes that disease gets bigger than the person. And so sometimes, you know, things that could not be on the forefront of the mind that, you know, every time I talk to Kat does not have that capacity to do her banking. But Kat knows what shirt she wants to wear. Uh-huh. Kat knows what shows she I mean, you know, so minimal, but empowering care partners, again, you know, if you say they have no capacity, that may not be fully accurate. We understand where you're coming from, but again, I'd say there are kind of levels to this, but it brings back the illustration, we're all human until the day we leave.
And if you heard someone say that about you, if you were next to someone who said she doesn't have capacity,
right,
how would you feel? That would really reduce you as a person.
And again, empowering, educating care partners, all of them out there. Things I teach, Kat, I know you've heard, in front of a person with the dementia, despite the stage or years they've been suffering, always assume they've heard everything you've said, because no one can prove that they don't, and we don't know what. And you hit that on the head. You know, one training I do with professionals is I'll pick a stranger out of the audience, never met them, but the audience knows them, and I'll sit them down and say, tell me about this person. Oh, by the way, Kat, you can't say a word in rebuttal. And, you know, and sometimes they're not flattering things. She always wears that ugly shirt every day. She's always late. I think she cheats sometimes. I mean, and you have to sit there and take it. So, again, putting yourself in the shoes of that person who can't respond to, they have no capacity, or, you know, Kat, she's been a little rambunctious today. She's been a little rowdy. She's a little more confused than usual. Again, just there's always that person-centered aspect.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's really what we're trying to do today, is help you understand some of the legalities of being a care partner, but also understanding the human aspect. We are humans, you know,
absolutely,
until that day we leave the earth.
And I want to throw out there this idea too, that while you're thinking about the person you're caring for and these legal documents and the roles that the law provides, think about planning for yourself too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's not just her that needs to do that medical power of attorney, right? It's you
Absolutely.
That needs to do one too. Might as well, you know, plan for your own future, especially with the knowledge that you have, the experience of being a caregiver. Like,
right.
You have a rich, rich background of things to start from to do your own planning now.
Right, right.
And so don't miss out on that opportunity. Like, don't let that get away from you.
Well, and I think, again, not that I was young, but I was in my mid-20s, and I think I'm not alone in this. At the time, it was focused on someone else, not me. That's how I looked at it. And so there were things I probably didn't do for myself, or many things we've talked about today that weren't on the forefront of my mind at that time. But now, if I could go back in my time machine, again, I always use this cliche, and not to frighten anyone, but what happens if I was in a car accident?
Yes.
What happens if I went down? Someone would need to know that I care for someone with a dementia at home. And that started the brain. I went down further in that trail. What if I got injured, or I don't have these things in place, and
yes,
I am my grandmother's and my mother's son, where there's certain people I don't want making any decisions for me. There are certain things I want that others in my family may not see the same way. You know, and if I could go back to tell that caregiver, is plan now as well, because there's always someone, whether it's the caregiver, it's a spouse, it's a friend, it's a neighbor, someone on the back end that's going to have to make very tough decisions and wonder whether it was right or what you wanted. And that just makes it harder for the people that we care about. So in a way, I would say what actually made me do it was – the people I love in my life. I did it for my nephew, my niece, my mother, you know, those people, because I saw as a caregiver the struggles of not having everything ready. And it's never an easy time, Kat. And I just wanted to, if you had any thought on this, when's the right time to talk about this, right?
I love this question. we started out by saying it could be uncomfortable. Yeah, I think culturally, especially when you're talking about the end of your life, mm-hmm. or the future of living with diminishing capacities, physical and cognitive diminishing capacities, you know, Americans probably spend, I don't know what the percent is, but a pretty large chunk of our economy is youth-oriented products, right? We like to live forever. You go to a funeral, and we spend a lot of money to make it look like the deceased person is merely sleeping peacefully, mm-hmm. right? Like, we just deny the end, deny it all. We love to do that. And so I think it culturally, it's weird to bring it up and say, hey, I want to talk about my death. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about my future if I can't, you know, if I get dementia like my grandmother did, which, by the way, if you have a brain, you're at risk for getting dementia. And if your grandmother had dementia, you're at even higher risk for it, right? So the likelihood that we're all going to get dementia is actually increasing at this point because we're mm-hmm. living longer. If you're ready, if you will bring it up, if you're the one that brings it up, and you don't have to say, hey, mom, I want to talk about your death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Start saying, I'm going to talk about JT's death. Family, let's discuss it, because I have a few things I'd like for you to know about myself.
Well, and Kat, I think that's a good point, because just to use myself again, any of those people I named, my mom, my nephew, my nieces, bringing it up under that context, here's what I use to my advantage. They love me. Yes. They care about me. And I'll be honest, not manipulating, but it's a lot harder to say, we're not talking about that when it was about me. Savvy thing I learned.
Yes.
But it also could open those doors. And I mean, and again, honesty, this is not always easy. You know, I've heard one doctor say, or maybe I've heard you say it too, Kat, not to be funny or mean, but I've heard sometimes, you know, after that Thanksgiving meal, we've had a few drinks where we're sitting around, someone brings it up, you know,
yes.
but again, I think, this is very important. It's never, I remember a college student one time asking me in a lecture, when do I need to go get a living will, think about these documents for myself? And almost unanimously, you heard the panel say now.
Oh,
you know,
I think so too. And to bring up the conversation too, it's not once. You don't do it one time. Do it multiple times, right? We just keep talking about it because our ideas can evolve. Our knowledge will evolve. So the more we know, the more we learn, the more we may have a little more detail about what we want to talk about. We may have, you know, new medical technologies emerge.
Absolutely.
That we learn about. I mean, I've seen a lot of, like I told you, I've seen House every episode.
Right.
I know about some stuff.
Right.
I know about some things I don't want and do want. So the more you learn, the conversation should just keep continuing. But I love the idea of like after Thanksgiving, because we're all together.
Right.
We're feeling we're all there. Good. We're feeling happy. You know, I think a little humor can go a long way,
absolutely.
You know, like lighten it up and just say, hey, I'm not trying to bring you down, mm-hmm. but I really don't want to be embalmed. I want to be planted under the apple tree in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Can I get get an amen?
Right.
I mean, like if you start out with something a little humorous, then maybe we can kind of relax.
Right.
And then
you
bring it up again and we're yet more relaxed. And I think, like you said, caregiver wants to know. The caregiver who's in a position to make decisions on another person's behalf, that's a heavy thing.
Absolutely.
You know, that is a very, you know, if you're taking it seriously, it can be pretty hard on you.
Sure.
How much more comforting would it be for the decision maker to know, I know how she wanted me to handle this.
Right.
She told me
many
times in front of the whole family.
Well, and that's another point when we're speaking about just all of us. I'll tell you a quick story. Me and my mother were talking one day and this conversation brought up, I think she brought it up first and just looked at me and said, she said, I want a slideshow at my funeral. And her and I have this debate. I do not want a slideshow, but I know my mom. And I said, here's the thing, Mom, I can write it down and all that, but if you're alive and I'm gone, I know what you'll probably do. So, so for her, she said, well, here's the thing. I have it all laid out, even the pictures I want in there, the clothes I want you to put on me, everything. And the seriousness in that conversation where there are some things that she and my sister probably wouldn't have seen eye to eye on. And I tell my mom a lot, thank you so much, because during that horrible time, that grief period, my sister and I will not be arguing, because we knew without a doubt, because we witnessed it as well, that you made that decision. So we don't have to debate about it. We don't have to argue about it or wonder. Yes. So that's actually a gift she's given us. Yes. You know, absolutely. One more question on the power of attorneys, Kat, because I'm just curious. So if I designate a person, or I choose the person to make some decisions for me when I can no longer, can I change that? Can I like fire that person, that agent?
Sure can. Okay. As long as you have the capacity to make that choice.
Okay.
Then you can destroy your old one, do a new one. Your new one effectively legally destroys your old one.
Okay.
So you can, as long as you have the capacity to make that choice, then you can legally make that choice anytime you want to.
Okay. I think that's a good point, just for people to know. Sometimes we're frightened that what if, you know, again, you choose that wrong person in your family or someone, something goes wrong, and you still have that ability to make that change.
Absolutely.
Okay. Kat, do you have just a few more minutes? Could we take a couple questions? From our caregivers, there's one that I really want to get to. I believe it's concern about the driving issue. And again, when I saw this, I thought, great question, because Kat and I both have brought this up together in the same room before. So can you see this, Kat?
Yes.
Okay. I'll read it just for our audience in case anyone can't read it. The care partner wrote, are there any laws or statutes in West Virginia that state a person cannot drive if they have Alzheimer's disease? Let's kind of take these one at a time, if you don't mind. So let's do the first part. No.
No.
Okay.
And that's in part because diagnosis has nothing necessarily to do with capacity.
Right.
And merely being diagnosed with a dementia or anything else does not mean that you don't have the capacity to do various legal things. Under law, that is, you have to evaluate the person's actual ability to do something in order for that person's capacity to be determined.
And one point you've probably heard me say, but I stress this, because again, it's not black and white, and with Alzheimer's especially, just because diagnosis is not enough, basically. Just because someone has Alzheimer's disease is not an automatic cause that they can't drive. It's deeper than that. There's stages,